My purpose tonight is just to recognize hands and let you folks tell the rest of us about the funniest thing that ever happened to you.
What if we all used to be audience?
Yeah. That would be a funny thing. Do we have a volunteer to start us off?
Well, 79, I bought a new Rolls and Oldsmobile. And it was a nice one. It had to be a pickup with a little off the car and touching a button on the driver's door and all over the lot. Well, we were showing some friends of ours, the car and how it rolled all the windows and you push a button, lock the car. And I could see, I pushed the button and slammed the door. And I looked and like he was in the car. Then I had to go searching out Iris and find another key. Luckily, she had another key.
Technology is wonderful, huh?
Since then, I have two keys. One in the car, one in my pocket.
I thought you were going to say, since then, you don't buy Oldsmobile. Okay, who's next here?
Come back some other time when this can be settled. So then I phoned again, they said, yes, Sergeant so-and-so this time will meet you at this time and come and see him. So I went back, again I sat in the hallways and so on, and then the sergeant came, but the sergeant said he had no appointment for me, and it turned out there were two sergeants with the same name. So I left again, and I said, I'm not going to face this ridiculous charge. And there were a fine of $200 and all kinds of money for having this car towed away and stored and so on. So I said, okay, I will let you phone me back when you can deal with me properly. So I phoned again, went back again, this time with a friend, sort of a businessman type guy who could deal with people well and with big booming voice and so on. So we went in there again, and again it didn't work out. And I waited, went from floor to floor. And so I said, okay, I have had it with you people, you can keep the car. And I left. I was barely home, the inspector phoned me and said, we're so sorry, Dr. Quant, that we've caused you all this trouble. We've dropped the charges, we've dropped everything. And we cannot, just come and get your car. We cannot, we cannot keep this car, you can't leave this on our hands. I guess this was the right thing to do, say, keep it. So I again had that car. And so then I thought, I again put it somewhere in our yard, and I thought to myself, I have to do something, and something good with this car. So I Ralph Nader had just read a wrote in the book, Unsafe at Any Speed, about this very car in 1964. Actually, I later met Ralph Nader and talked to him about this, but he had just written this book, and this car had become famous. So I thought I would phone my brother-in-law, who lived a few hundred miles away from where I was, who owns a very large farm in Alberta, in Canada. I said, would you have some prairie somewhere, some virgin country where we could, he has a big caterpillar and a backhoe and so on. I said, could we build a vault where we could seal this car and store it? So a friend of mine and I towed it down a few hundred miles to this place in October 1975, and we built this vault, and then with treated timber and plastic and everything else, and we put all kinds of things in there that really would remind us of the time when it was stored. And we drove the car in there, we sealed it in plastic, and then put these big timbers across, covered it all up, a little mound remained, put a cross on it, had a little dust or rust to had it all. We had this on we took a movie of it. we called it 1975 to 1995 when I wanted to resurrect this vehicle. So that's the kind of story of my 1964 career.
Okay. There was an old program called Can You Top This? Remember that? All right, who's next? You got a car story?
I have a car story.
All right, let's hear a car story for a change.
Oh, okay, somebody else is done with
it. That's all right.
I am married to a man who is rather forgetful. And
is he here now?
Yeah.
He's probably forgotten.
And it's also seldom on time. And we had a cottage group with our church that used to do a lot of really interesting things together. And this one evening, we had all decided to go and see the movie Billy Joel. The rest of the group had arrived on time. We arrived late, as usual. They were saving seats for us, so when we got there, of course, there was very little parking available, and we had to park a couple of blocks away from the theater. We did. It was cold, snowy. We ran to the theater. If you have seen the movie, you'll know it's it's a little longer than the average movie. And when it was all over, we looked frantically for our key. They were nowhere to be found. We had, this particular group, there's about 16 of us, who were down on our hands and knees, looking under the theater chairs. We had people picking their feet up, cleaning their popcorn off the floor. We had lost our keys. So we had just decided that we'd have to go home with friends and come back the next day. And we all piled out of the theater, kind of mumbling under our breath. Peter, we arrived at the car. Discover.
Was this an Oldsmobile?
This was an Oldsmobile. We arrived at the car, find the lights on, the motor running.
Okay. Now, where was that hand out here?
Well, I'm hearing the doctor, and you know all those long words and everything like that?
They're under your first marriage.
They're also very forgetful, I understand.
I have this medical magazine sitting down there, and I'm not going to spell it, I'm not going to pronounce it right, because I go, honey, what's psoriasis? And instead of psoriasis, but anyway, he just starts laughing and just rolls all over the chairs and everything. But psoriasis is a skin disease, but I said, what's psoriasis?
The rest of us thought you pronounced it correctly. Okay, anything from the balcony?
What are we doing?
Shy people here. We've got funny stories they're just dying to tell, but worried about raising that hand.
One time I went to a meeting in Seattle at the University of Washington. They have enormous parking lots there. Just mile long, I think. I parked my car in the new parking lot. And in there I met several of my friends who had the meeting too, and about four or five of them, you know, didn't have rides home back to Bremerton, which is a ferry ride. And I said, well, you can ride with me back home. After we got out of the meeting, we started walking to the parking lot. And I walked to where I thought it was, and the car wasn't there. Well, it must have been another lot. So my friends followed me, and I looked for another lot, wasn't there. I'd plain forgotten where I had parked my car. I just grabbed the car, and my friends split up, and we finally found the car. We were inviting them to come take them home. It's been 15 minutes looking for the damn car. That was very embarrassing.
There was a hand down here by the teller.
I was just thinking, I was out on a first date with this guy that I had not known very well, and so of course I was a little nervous. It was a bright sunny day, and about 5 in the afternoon we were supposed to go and meet this other couple who I didn't know and eat. And we get to the restaurant and we go inside, and it's very dark inside, and it had been bright outside. And so I'm walking in and I'm really thirsty. It was in the middle of the summer, and I sit down at the table and I grab the pitcher of water which is on there, and I'm talking. You know, when I get nervous, I talk, and I'm pouring into what I think is the glass, only I forgot to check if the glass was turned right on. I'm not watching, so here there are ice cubes. And the funniest part that I can laugh about now is he never asked me out again.
I can understand that.
I have one. I work a lot with boilers and machinery, and I went to work for Crown Zeller back in Oregon City. And one of the first years I was there, one of the jobs we have to do in that field is do a lot of inspection of equipment that's under license to the state, such as air tanks and what have you. And a lot of these, like air tanks was the one thing, is a very small manhole that you have to crawl through to get inside to make an internal inspection of the tank. Well, here I am, this young kid, and all these older millwrights and inspectors and things. And so, being in the position I was the one that would crawl in with the inspector. So I shimmy into the tank and we inspect it. And I go to get out and I can't get over my belt button. So I hand my belt out. This one is impeding me from getting out of the tank. And sure enough, I managed to make it out of the tank, but I left my pants inside.
Would you send somebody else in after the pants?
I could retrieve in very embarrassing way.
Okay.
I was doing my residency in ophthalmology, and at a veterans hospital, this old fellow, we had a lot of old veterans that would come in and be examined for glasses. This old guy says, I don't need any glasses. And I said, well, we'll see. And I put up the lens equipment. And I say, okay, read that. And he started reading letters that weren't even on the chart. And I couldn't figure out what the heck he was reading until he spelled out the whole thing. E-X-I-T. And he was reading the sign. Down the hallway at the end of the building.
Well, everybody's making themselves vulnerable, so I guess
that's the spirit.
Yeah. But when I was going to school in the Midwest, I lived in California at that time, and my parents, I would fly from California back to Missouri, and my parents would always load me down at Christmas and holidays with oranges and soap and all these kinds of things, which I would put in paper bags. And when I got to the plane, we'd take off. And this usual thing was, of course, for the soap and oranges and everything go trailing down the aisle, and people roll them back up. So finally, I had a kind of an old maid aunt who was a very lovable, caring person. And she gave me, hearing my stories all the time, how I could never put this stuff together. She gave me a case. It was about this size, you know, but it was just enough to get a few oranges and some soap and all those important things in that case. So I was really pleased with this. You know, I was kind of proud she thought of me and really pleased that she had given this case to me. So I got on the plane and I took the case and I put it under my seat. You know, you're allowed to put some smaller luggage underneath your seat. So I put it under the seat and got my seat buckle on and everything ready to go. And then I thought, well, gosh, you know what's going to happen is the plane's going to take off, and that's going to go, you know, rolling down the aisle. So to prevent that from happening, I'll just reach down and hold on to it, you know, while we're on takeoff. So I did just that. I immediately grabbed onto it, so I was holding it the whole time. The plane just went to the runway and I was holding on to him. We took off and went all the way up to the end. Finally, all the signs went off and everything went off, and I finally looked down and I let go of a man's foot behind me.
We take off in the truck and we get halfway there and we can't turn around and go back to get anything. And my mom looks at my dad and she goes, "Honey, I forgot the checkbook." No money.
Back here.
Forgetting a checkbook, then I hadn't thought of this until you said forget a checkbook. We had something similar to that. We attended church as we should, and at 11 o'clock service. We had four sons, and they were all down in Sunday school, and we had to get home. Probably it was an NFL game or something, so we got about three blocks from the church, and I said, "I think there's somebody missing. We left one of them back in Sunday school."
Sounds like Jesus in the temple.
Well, doctors shouldn't talk so much, but I have a partner who then will be, and nowadays we depend so much on gadgetry that we forget our own intuition. And he, on this lovely young lady who was expecting her first, I think it was not her first baby, and they did ultrasound, and He told her it was supposed to be a girl, a boy. And so time came to deliver her, and Dr. McCluskey delivered her and held the baby and gave it to the mother. Because she had natural birth and didn't go to sleep. And said, "Here, here's your fine boy, Mrs. So-and-so." She said, "Doctor, will you look again?" He looked, it was a girl. The doctor will be looking at me. He hadn't even bothered to look, all he delivered the baby, you see.
How come some doctors can tell if a mother is nursing the wrong baby and other doctors?
Actually, that reminds me of another story like where in Canada now we have a lot of shortage of staff and so on, and not because there isn't any, but because there aren't enough people to staff these positions, but money is short, and so we're running hospital wards with very few staff. And not that long ago, one of my patients was in labor, and she'd been in the labor room, and then she was getting closer to being delivered, so she was moved into the case room. And the staff was so busy in other places with other women in labor that she was alone in the room for a while, And then I came in after she'd been alone there for quite a while, and I said, "How are you doing?" And she said, "Was there a nurse in here just a minute ago?" I said, "No, nurses are all over there with somebody else." "Well, any residents or interns in here a few minutes ago?" "No." She said, "Well, then the janitor must have examined me."
Okay.
complicated diagnoses, and in one medical class, it was the fourth year class, and we had small groups that would go in, into the different clinics, and the clinician would bring in a patient and ask us to ask questions and come up with a diagnosis and the differential and everything else. And this obviously pregnant woman was brought in, and one of the students in our group, and it wasn't me, he was always thinking of the what they call the canaries, the oddball diagnoses, and he came up with the diagnosis, and the clinician came back and said, well, what's your diagnosis? And this is a technical term this fellow came up with. He said pseudocyesis, which means false pregnancy. And the clinician says, well, I can't believe it. You're calling this a pseudocyesis. Why not just obvious pregnancy? And the medical student said, well, she's obviously not pregnant. She's not married. Jokes. I remember one time outside the medical lecture room, we saw a nice little advertisement, and it said, a two-year-old pair of robes, brown, with new laces, original price, such and such, $12. And so we would write things at the bottom, I'm willing to trade a pair of old shorts for your robes, and other sort of variety of things. And it happened that one day, that particular day, we were in a cardiology lecture, and we were being taught about the heart medication digitalis. And at the end of the class, he was always the one that would ask questions. When the teacher would say, are there any questions? Nobody else would ask questions. They wanted to get out of the room. But he would ask questions, and he'd say, at the end of this digitalis lecture, he'd say, when you digitalize someone, is that when you do open heart massage? He was serious, and he became an MD.
Okay, who's next here? We've got to laugh at somebody, it might as well be you, right?
I had a story about my students.
Good. No names.
They'll blush anyway. When they're just new students, they must have been in the second year, I suppose, when they were up on the wards. Just kind of getting the feel of things and beginning to know and to learn what to do. There were these two young men who came in to take a lady's blood pressure. And this particular lady was very beautiful. She had long hair, and she was wearing a very filmy negligee. And the first med student put on the blood pressure cuff and pumped it up like crazy and put a stethoscope on her arm, things in his ears. No blood pressure. Step up, tried it again. Stethoscope back on the arm. Still no blood pressure. He had the cuff around the wrist.
There's a similar story to that. Every med student eventually does something like that. That he didn't put the stethoscope in his ears. He was listening with it still around his ears. And another med student, particularly precocious young girl in pediatrics, and she was well developed, and he was wanting her to take some deep breaths, and so he said, big breaths, big breaths.
Puts us non-medical people at a great disadvantage.
I'll tell a C story. And it wasn't myself, it was a guy who worked opposite me. I used to work in the offshore drilling industry on drilling ships. And every other day or maybe twice a week, a work boat would come out and we'd exchange supplies, send equipment in and get equipment back off. Well, this was down in the lower end of Argentina. And as most countries we worked in, a majority of the crew were nationals. And the drilling crew, superintendents and engineers and things were all expatriates. And so there was always a language problem. And we had this large piece of machinery we had to send in to be overhauled. And so the other engineer in his eloquent Spanish told the helpers to take it up out of the engine room, put it on the deck, and the workboat would come and pick it up. They had made a special trip out for that piece of machinery. And they came back and said, well, where is it? And they could see where they dragged it, up the ladders, across the deck, and over the side.
Well, that brings me to, doctors are not the only ones who get this, but occasionally, you foolish things, although should it be much more than nurses. Nurses are also occasionally known for doing some things. And I remember when I was in school, we had a student in our class. Gosh, she must have been a sister. She's a nurse somewhere today, too. I don't know, but anyway, she was working on the floor one day, and she got on the, you know, as a student nurse, you go in and you see who your patients are, and you figure out all the things you need to do and get your schedule arranged. She'd been assigned an elderly gentleman who was somewhat senile, and she had to get him down to extra, which was on... We were on like the third floor, around 3 South, and the x-ray was down in the basement of the hospital. And she was told to take him down to x-ray first thing. And so she got him in a wheelchair, and she put a tie around him and everything else, and came down to the elevator where the elevators were. And the elevators, though, that at that particular time, were out of order. They were working on them. So she went over to one of the instructors, and she said to her, you know, the elevator's out of order. What am I supposed to do with this patient? And I'm just sitting down to x-ray. Well, that instructor at that time was helping another student get an enema together that had to be done right away. And she just said, you know, just don't bother me. You have your work to do. I'll get it done. I don't care. You know, just get that patient to x-ray. That's what you gotta do. So it was about 20 minutes later, she got the instructor got a call on the ward. And here was this student. And the instructor said, well, what's the problem? Did you get this patient x-ray? She said, yes, I did. And she said, well, what is the problem? And she said, well, I don't know how to get him back up the stairs. I have no idea how she did not kill me.
Okay, anybody else have one to throw in here? How about this side of the balcony?
No, we don't want to tell them. We don't do.
She's got two.
Brooklyn.
Your house on Brooklyn.
Oh! Maybe tell about Brooklyn
too. Go ahead. You remember
Okay, so we lived in Seattle out in the University District, and it was not a quiet street, but it was this wide sidewalks, and it was safe enough for Susie when she was about 3 to ride her tricycle up and down the sidewalk. And one Sunday afternoon, we went out to look. She'd been riding her tricycle, and she was gone. And we looked in the backyard and over the neighbors where she often played, and she wasn't there. And the neighbors helped us, and we proceeded around the neighborhood to knock on doors and ask where, you know, they seemed to be. And we went down to the corner store, which was one of her favorite places to ride, and she wasn't there. And, you know, we were just really getting frantic. The next step was to call the police. And then the neighbor lady happened to look in our bathroom, and there she was sitting on her little ducky seat on the toilet, sound asleep.
A couple of years ago, we were in a restaurant, family having a dinner, having a nice meal. All of a sudden, the lights started going dim and bright, dim and bright. Somebody was playing with the lights. We were looking all over. That's my wife. Was playing with the lights.
And it lasted 25 years.
I have another confessional to make. When Jan and I were married, we were married in Australia, and we went to honeymoon in a place called Park Towers, which was one of the lush hotels in downtown Perth. And being in the mechanical mind and curiosity, we're sitting at the breakfast table in the morning, and I look up and I see this funny thing in our room. I see this funny thing on the ceiling. I said, I think it's just a thermostat. So I popped the cover off and looked at it. I said, yeah, it's a thermostat. And I stuck it back together again. And we went out on the veranda and had breakfast, and we heard all these sirens. And 15 minutes later, there's this knock on the door. And the door comes open, and here's this fireman in full ordeal. He has the axe and everything. And he says, is there a fire in this room?
The fireman went in, checked the waste basket. He said, what was the thing? It was reported from this floor,
And I was just looking at one of those Herman jokes. Joke books, and there's one of them with the man sitting at his desk or table, and the fireman pointing a great big nozzle at him. He says, just because it was a false alarm, I give you just a little squirt.
Medically dominated, but we have a friend in Wisconsin.
Too late now.
And we were back to visit him at 25th medical school anniversary graduation. And he's so full of stories, and he said that, and he was from a small town in Wisconsin, and where everybody knows everybody practically. And there was quite a scandal that was statewide known, where a young man had been in the service and he had murdered him over this. A couple. Well, I think he was accused of it. What happened is, apparently this was a relative, Ann Buck or something. He went AWOL from the service in the Army and didn't go back, and they're supposed to, because leave was off. And he was hiding away on this couple's farm, and after a while, the aunt and uncle told him, we've known you a long time, and we like you, but you should go back to the service. And you must be AWOL now, but you know your leave is off. Well, he said, I'm not going back. Well, the other day, they became our assistants, that legally you must go back. Well, a few days later, the young man disappeared, and the sheriff found that this old other couple had been bludgeoned to death. And there were no witnesses, but this friend of mine, Dr. Brown, was also the county coroner. And so he went out and studied it, and they did autopsies and so on. And he was a good witness, but his testimony was the testimony that was strongest against this young man who was caught and brought back for trial. It was quite a stink, and the newspaper reported from all over. And apparently, the family of this young man didn't want him to be electrocuted, whatever it is. He's in Wisconsin now. They hired a high-powered city lawyer from Milwaukee or Chicago to come in and defend this young man. Well, the trial went along, and Dr. Brown came and testified, and but the high-powered lawyer was so glib and worked up a beautiful case to try to prove that the young man was innocent and somebody else did it. But he made the mistake of running down Dr. Brown. He went to great extent to asking Dr. Brown questions, about his background, what the right to do at the corner, were you trained at the corner, and so on and so on, and belittled Dr. Brown greatly, without realizing that almost all the entire jury had been patients of Dr. Brown for about 25 years. Couldn't be helped in this whole house. Well, you might know what the verdict was, this young man was sentenced to being guilty promptly within a very short time in the jury that was hearing out.
Well, in a sense, the people on the jury, all this embarrassing...
They tried to embarrass Dr. Brown, belittle him, and this high-power lawyer just didn't let the smartness realize that Dr. Brown was well-known at these hearings.
Yeah.
Want to tell them about Dr. Brown?
I was for a brief day in Seattle for a number of years. But when I first went to work there, I was almost in awe of the place because there had been, it was a very nice CPA office, and the girl that I replaced had been there about 10 years. And the girl that was training me was just going to be leaving because she had been waiting to get a baby, to adopt a baby, and was going to be leaving. So here I was going to be head girl, and I'd only been there about a month. But she warned me, now, Mr. Moss, when you write his letters, you type it exactly the way he writes it. You don't make changes, punctuation, or anything. Well, since my English is pretty good, my punctuation and everything is, so I was aware that suddenly in this letter something didn't seem quite right. The CPA Society of Washington State was going to be hosting a convention of Washington and Oregon Society, and the hotels were going to be so full of Seattle with another convention that the Oregon Society stepped into the breach to take us over. So Mr. Moss's letter was writing them and thanking them for stepping into the breach. Only he spelled breach, B-R-E-E-C-H. So I thought, well, I'm not going to ask him. I looked up in the dictionary to confirm it, and I spelled it B-R-E-A-C-H. And I just went ahead and left it that way, and I figured he wasn't even going to notice it. Well, he comes out with that letter smiling, and he's just roaring with laughter, thanking me for catching this spelling here. And so after that, I just didn't worry anymore if I saw this trick.
Okay, now our time has really run out here, but if there are any hilarious stories that cannot be go out of this room untold, this is your chance.
Surely you must have one yourself at the top of the phone.
I don't, you know, I was trying to think of some really funniest thing. I've learned a lot of little things that happened there, like getting this shirt here, which is a large size and comes down to my knees if I don't. Here we go.
I interned in a very, very conservative Lutheran church where the only ones permitted to go behind the altar rail were the certified altar guild members who wore booties and gloves and the whole business. And even the trustees were not allowed to go back there to collect the money unless an authorized altar guild member with her booties and gloves would give the offering place to them.
Did they let the pastor go back?
Well, they made an exception for the pastor, the lowly intern. We were allowed to go back there. Well, as you know with what Christmas programs are like, you know, they dump them on whoever they can do it. Well, the intern got dumped with the Christmas program. So we were doing a diorama type of thing with lights on and lights off and have scene changes. And I knew that in this one particular scene change, I knew where the reader was at and the lights were about to come on. And there was no way that I could get back stage without going over the altar railing, and I thought, well, it's dark, I can leap over the altar railing, I'll get through the door before anybody sees me. Well, just as I'm going over the altar railing, the lights came on. Nobody said anything at the coffee hour, not a word. And I got, and I asked my wife when we got home, I said, did you see me? And she said, yes, I saw you. But no one said anything. It was just like, you know, And about a week later, I was having coffee with my secretary, and she looked at me and she said, did you take class in school? That was the only comment that was made about my people in the office.
Where was your next parish?
We left the next week. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good one to end on. And so I thank you all for sharing your stories. That was a lot of fun.